Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Augustine Burroughs, who reads from and discusses his new book, Possible Side Effects, published by St. Martin's Press. In the weeks to come, we have Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Berg, Francine Matthews, John Berendt, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Augustine Burroughs is the author of the memoirs Running with Scissors and Dry and the essay collection Magical Thinking, all of which were instant bestsellers both in hardcover and paperback. Running with Scissors remained on the New York Times bestseller list for over 2.5 consecutive years, and we're anxiously awaiting the release of a feature film based on the book this fall. Augustine is also the author of the novel Cellavision, and his books have been published in over 17 countries. In March of 2003, Augustine was named to Entertainment Weekly's annual list of the 25 funniest people in America. He has also been named to that magazine's definitive It list, but I suspect that many of you in this room know that, and that's the reason that you're here tonight. We're delighted that Augustine has returned to the Tattered Cover to present his new collection, Possible Side Effects. Would you please join me in giving him the warmest of welcomes?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming out. I wanted to tell you a little story about my brother, so I figured that I would read a little essay about him as an introduction. I'm going to edit this just a little bit in my head, so to take out any potential naughty bits. This is called What's in a Name. My older brother had a supernaturally low voice at the age of 17. This fact, combined with his undiagnosed Asperger's syndrome, resulted in a boy who sounded like a machine speaking from the center of a deep cave. "Varmint," he would call from his bedroom. "Get in here, varmint." And I would drop whatever I was doing, which usually involved a hairbrush for one reason or another, and walk into his room, feigning an air of disinterest, but secretly thrilled. "Yeah, what do you want?" I would say, in as superior a tone as I could muster. My brother never called me by my actual name. He was 7 when I was born, and from this moment on, he called me Varmint. Because I idolized him in the fashion that younger brothers will idolize older brothers, no matter how freakish and defective they might be, I loved the name. When I asked him once, "What is a varmint?" he said, "A varmint is a small, furry animal." Standing at his door, my brother said, "Varmint, I need you to do something. I need you to go next door and attract the Haley's dog over here. Use scraps of meat or hot dogs, whatever's in the refrigerator. Just lure it inside and then bring it into the basement. Go now, hurry." My brother was always in the midst of an experiment. If he wasn't connected to the mainframe computer at the University of Massachusetts and reprogramming it to obey only him, he was making all our telephones ring when somebody pushed the doorbell. Although my parents became very upset and sometimes potential defendants, they were proud that he was clever enough to create problems that they themselves couldn't even quite understand. I was happy to be part of any sort of plan he had in his head. I may not have understood much about my brother, but I always felt he had a large plan, and if the plan was followed, allowed to unfold, it would be entertaining. "All right," I mumbled. I always had to watch my tone around him because high-pitched, girlish screams of delight would irritate him, and I might find myself locked inside of something I just couldn't get out of. Luring the Halley's dog into the house would be easy. It was a stupid friendly Irish setter with a smooth bubble head and a tendency to follow. I went to the refrigerator and opened the sliding drawer marked salad crisper. Why my mother kept the meats in the salad crisper drawer instead of the drawer marked specifically meats was a mystery to me. One of many about her. I pulled a hot dog from the greasy Oscar Mayer package and then removed another for an emergency situation. Next, I walked outside and cut through the woods that separated our house from the Hallies. It would have been much easier to simply shout, call their dog over to our front door. But then, this might have attracted attention. People would think nothing of little Augustine calling their dog, but this is not what they would have thought. They would have thought, with some distress, why is John's little brother calling for our dog? My brother had infected me. With hot dogs crammed into my pockets, I stalked through the woods, avoiding the pit. The pit was an area of excavation, roughly 3 feet by 5 feet deep. It was covered with branches, and then a top layer of brown leaves and pine boughs to blend into the rest of the forest. I dug the pit myself with the intention of creating an in-ground swimming pool. As it turned out, it was far more difficult to dig a swimming pool than I had expected, so I'd covered the pit with branches, creating the next best thing, a trap. Our neighbor's house came into view. It was a three-story contemporary salt box, tall and flat in the front, tapering down at the rear. It was exactly the house I wished we lived in, a much nicer house than ours, with three fieldstone fireplaces and shag carpeting in every room, and central vacuuming. Instead of central vacuuming, all I had was a mother who pushed the Electrolux around while she smoked and dropped ashes behind her. When I got to the edge of the Hallies' property, I stopped because I saw Rusty curled up in the sun on the top step. I needed to get his attention, but not startle him and cause him to bark. I removed the hot dog from my pocket and held it up in the air, hoping that the scent would drift past his nose, carried on air currents. When nothing happened, I snuck it back in my pocket and used my psychic abilities to call him over, silently repeating his name, even mouthing the words. When this failed, I picked up a stick and cracked it across my thigh. This caused Rusty to raise his head and look in my direction. So I immediately threw both arms high above my head and waved them. Then I did a little dance in place. Having recognized me, Rusty stood, stretching and arching his back. Then his tail began to wag, and he clopped down the steps, skipping every other one. He came right up to me, and I grabbed an ear in each hand. Good boy, I said. Good boy. I shook his ears, something he liked. Then I said, come on, Rusty, follow me. Rusty remained in place. Come on, Rusty, I said, as friendly as possible. No threat, no basement in my voice at all. Still, Rusty refused to follow me. Instead, he glanced back at his house, and the look on his face told me he wasn't sure. To make him sure, I pulled out a hot dog. Now, he followed me. Along the way, I broke off small, motivational pieces to feed him. When I got Rusty up to the front step of my own house, I couldn't get him to follow me inside. I tossed the last piece on the area rug, and I could tell Rusty wanted it, but he wouldn't go. So I removed the emergency hot dog and showed it to him. Look, I said, turning it slowly, a whole big fresh hot doggy. I tossed it inside and Rusty chased after it. Then I followed him in and closed the door, calling out for my brother. Okay, I got him. My brother appeared, a smile on his face. Huh, he grunted with a smile, clearly pleased. You really did get him. That's good work, varmint. My brother's compliments were extremely valuable because he rarely doled them out. Yep, that's very good work. Now we've got him. But we need to get him downstairs. Here, I'll just carry him. My brother moved in and hoisted Rusty in his arms. Rusty looked alarmed. I followed my brother downstairs into the basement. Close that, he said, and I shut the basement door behind us. To my surprise, the basement had been transformed. A clean white sheet was spread out on the floor, along with two cans of paint and some brushes. All right, he said. Now you have to hold the dog while I equip him. What do you mean, equip him? I asked, holding Rusty in place where he stood, stroking his belly from below. Well, we're going to equip him for the track, my brother said. I had no idea what he was talking about, even as he began painting a thick black line down the length of Rusty's back. I had no clue what he was doing. Only when he added the number 57 in orange paint did I get it. My brother said, "There we go, racing stripes." I was thrilled. I let go of Rusty and he did a mad sniffing dance around the basement. He bent forward on his front feet and wanted to play. Then he caught a whiff of himself and started sniffing the air, then his tail, trying to touch his nose to his back. My brother laughed. Huh, isn't that great? It was great. Do our dog, I said. Paint her. My brother said, no, we can't paint our dog because then people will know who painted this one. I threw a balled-up sock for Rusty, and he bolted for it. He didn't seem damaged by the customization. He seemed perfectly happy. Will the paint hurt him? I asked, suddenly worried. Nah, it's paint for kids. Kids can eat this paint and be okay. Even if he's able to lick it all off, oh, he might throw up, but that's it. Then he added, I would have preferred to use car paint, but that might have had an adverse effect on the animal, so we had to use kid paint. Then I said, paint me. And my brother said, no, it's time for a new activity now. Here, go let the dog out. He walked across the basement to the door that led to the backyard. Now, Rusty didn't want to leave. Quickly, he'd become ours. Come on, 57, my brother said. It's time for you to go be released into the wild and race among the other animals. The dog, for some reason, listened to my brother, seeming to understand him. He stepped over the door jamb and trotted across the yard, looking back once. My brother reassured him, "Go on, you're free to run now." And the dog took off for his own house. That evening, the phone rang. As always, my mother picked it up, expecting it to be one of her many poet friends. But a moment later, she called out, "John Elder, come here." My brother was back in his room, and I was in there with him. I was sorting through the debris on the floor, copper wires, transistors, small electronic components. I was looking for pennies, which I was gathering into a pile. So far, I had 32. My brother was attached to the university computer using a modem. My mother came into the room. "John Elder, did you paint racing stripes on the Haley's dog?" she demanded. Without looking up from his screen, my brother said, "I'm busy now, slave. Go away." My mother gathered authority. "Answer my question. Did you paint racing stripes on the neighbor's dog?" Again, my brother failed to look at her. "No, I did not paint racing stripes on any local animal. And I'm extremely busy. Go away." She exhaled in frustration and turned to leave. "Slave," my brother said. She turned back. "What is it?" she asked, angry and abrupt. "Bring me a glass of water." My brother closed his door, nearly a slam, but returned a moment later with a glass of ice water, resting it on the only clear spot on the table next to him. For the remainder of the summer, my brother called Rusty 57. Long after the Halleys had washed the paint off his coat, the dog responded to his new name. And even though my brother never admitted to what he had done, the Halleys knew and made every effort to keep 57 indoors. But the same year, the principal of the high school gave my brother a new name all his own, Suspended. By his account, the principal suspended him because I'm too smart and they don't know what to do with me. But when my parents inquired further, phoning a number of my brother's friends, they got another side to the story, a side that included a motorcycle in a hallway near the gym. "Now you tell the truth. Did you ride your motorcycle inside the school building?" my mother wanted to know. My brother shrugged. "Yeah, I guess." As always, his monotone veiled his emotions. "Well, my mother stammered. "Yep, that's pretty much what the principal said," my brother replied. "But you're expelled, John Elder. What are you going to do now that you're expelled?" My brother shrugged. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'll collect garbage for the town of Springfield. Or, who knows, maybe I'll take that little Shelby girl and reconfigure her as a boy. My mother was horrified. Don't you even joke about something like that. You need to apologize to the school so they take you back, and then you need to graduate. But really, what was the point? My brother had read all the textbooks for the entire 4 years within the first 5 weeks of his freshman year, and the only reason he hadn't been suspended before was because he programmed the high school's computers for them as a favor. Well, slave, why don't you make yourself useful? Go get me an iced tea, and maybe I'll think about returning to school. My mother sighed. Well, I'll get you this one iced tea, but then I need you to think about what you're going to say to the school. She remained in the doorway, watching him. But my brother had already turned away and was focused intently on his new project. He was going to build an electric guitar that could spit fire and shoot a rocket. Thank you. So my brother actually did that. He ended up building guitars in his bedroom for KISS, for the World Dynasty Tour. All these electric guitars that shot rockets and made really amazing patterns with light, little built-in electrodes and smoking. And so now I live next door to my brother. We moved out to Amherst so that we could live next to my nephew, who at that time was 12, going on 13. And I wanted to be there, you know, while he's in high school. And my brother called one day and he said, well, we bought a house, we're building a house in Amherst, you know, come look. And we drove out there and, you know, he's got his little house lot. And I remember thinking I would hang myself before I lived on this street. But we ended up buying the house two houses down on the same street. And my brother and I then proceeded to build our houses side by side. Now, we built a small house, but it's pretty. You know, it has, like, beadboard in the bathroom and crown molding. My brother built an Asperger's dream house. Asperger's syndrome it's on the spectrum of autism. So my brother is just a shocking genius, but he's a little odd. So one of the things he did, you know, for most of us, the front door to our home says, welcome, come in, have some iced tea. My brother's front door, right over the front door, is a big steam pipe that belches steam 24 hours a day. And I was like, John Elder, what is that thing? Well, that's the hot water heater ventilation. Well, we have a hot water heater. It doesn't belch out steam. Well, that's right, you know, because you have an inferior residential hot water heater. We got a commercial hot water heater that could service a Chili's with a seating capacity of 185. But it's just you and your wife and a 50... He's not going to take showers for like 5 years. You know, you don't need that. And then, you know, he's got all these garages. There's garages upstairs and then there are garages downstairs. Downstairs is a combination living room and garage. So you drive in and you literally have to watch to make sure you don't hit a couch. And then upstairs, it almost looks like a typical garage, except there's a big steel I-beam that runs across, like you might see at a skyscraper. And I said, well, what is that? Why do you have a steel I-beam? Well, you know, the average person can't have a 3,000-pound object inside their house because the main structure wouldn't be able to support it. But we have fortified the main structure of this house, so that's not a problem. But that still opens the issue of how to get the 3,000-pound object in the house. But for us, that won't be a problem because we will have a traveling crane. It will attach to that steel I-beam and travel back to the opening of the garage door. There, we can pull a flatbed truck right up to the garage, unload the 3,000-pound object, and get it into the house. And what 3,000-pound object do you have in mind? What are you going to be? Well, I didn't say I had a particular 3,000-pound object in mind. But if we find one, we're going to be able to have it, unlike you. So, and in his garage, he's got like, I mean, they're really efficient. They're great, I guess, right? They're these really high-intensity, very, very super efficient fluorescent lights. And they're about, they're probably about half the width, about that long, about the length of that desk and about half as wide. So he's probably got 1, 2, 3, 4 of those. in the garage because he works on his cars. He services them. That's fine, right? Well, the original blueprints for the house featured those lights everywhere. Over the breakfast table, hanging from a steel chain in the bathroom. Next to the guest bedroom table thing, the little bedside table in the guest bedroom, these were everywhere. And his wife came in and was like, I'll divorce you. I want normal person lights. You know, he's weird with like lights. When we finally moved in, he gave us a housewarming present. And it was a little box. And it was wrapped. And that's not like my brother. He doesn't wrap. But it was wrapped. And I thought, well, this is special. You know, he's, because now we're neighbors. You know, the brothers live together like the Car Talk guys. So, which is his dream. So I opened the present that he wrapped with his own little paws. And inside are two mercury gas discharge lamps. Do you know what those are? Those are parking lot lamps. And so they're, he said, well, you know, you attach them to the house, and these will illuminate into the woods a half a mile, like daylight. And he said, you'll be able to see your house from the highway. Yeah, and then he said, yep, it's going to be great. You know, it's really going to look like there's a gas station in the woods. I swear, as if that's a good thing. That's a look we're going for. So this year we had had a lot of snow in Massachusetts, and the snowplow guy, you know, just wasn't great from the previous year. So a lot of the neighbors have been doing their own plowing and are directly across from us. Our neighbors bought a little thing, you know, you ride it. You get on it and you ride it and it kind of blows the snow. Not to be outdone by the neighbors. The very next morning, all of the neighborhood woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning to the sound of hell cracking as my brother drove. I mean, it is as tall as this road. It's a huge professional tractor with a plow and a blowing thing. It's like the, have you ever seen specials on diamond mining? It's that kind of tractor. I mean, it's not consumer, not even construction site. So he's going down the road, boo, you know, and he's blowing the snow up all over the neighbors' walkways into like a mound so that all day they're all shoveling out, you know, and they're not going to say anything because he means well, you know. So there's a little about my brother in case you were wondering. You guys have any questions you want to ask? Just feel free. My brother, it's interesting. His first word was car. And for a number of years, he designed sound systems for huge rock bands. Not only sound systems, but special effect guitars. And he did that when he was a teenager. Then he went to work for Milton Bradley. I think it was Milton Bradley. He designed toys, electronic toys, when they were very new. Then he worked for another corporation, didn't like it, and now he owns a dealership. He services and sells Range Rovers and Rolls Royces and Mercedes, and he's great because genetically, I guess it's because of the... My brother can't lie. He can't do it. Ever. Never. Not even when he's meeting his wife's sister. Right? Huh. So you're 50 and still single, right? I guess that about makes lesbianism your only option. He said that. And you can imagine how close they are to this day. But it's great. It's great when you're selling cars because, you know, he's got these wealthy clients, you know, that come in and he just tells them like it is, you know. He's great. So that's what he does. Yes. When is the movie version of Running with Scissors coming out, and did I write the screenplay? The movie is released, I think it's September 21st, I think is the date. And no, I didn't write the screenplay. Ryan Murphy is the director, and he also wrote the screenplay. Ryan Murphy is the creator of Nip Tuck. I actually was not going to option Running with Scissors because I felt that it would be too easy to make a very sort of tawdry kitsch, campy movie out of it, and I wasn't going to option it. But Ryan kept emailing and phoning me and my agent, so I just decided to have lunch with him and just explain my thinking to him and tell him, you know, I'm not going to ever option it to anybody. It's not just you. But we ended up speaking, you know, spending the whole lunch talking about his mom and how similar his mom is to mine. And he really understood the book in sort of the way only the writer could. I mean, it was really stunning. And by the end of lunch, I mentally optioned it to him. Now, he hadn't done anything at that point that I'd seen. All he had done professionally was create a series called Popular for the WB Network. And I knew about the show, and I'd heard good things about it, but I'd never seen it. So at the end of lunch, he said, you know, this is really exciting, and I'm going to start working on Running with Scissors as soon as I get the pilot for this show I'm developing out of the way. It's about cosmetic surgeons in L.A., and I'm going to, you know, take that Golden Globe away from The Sopranos. And I thought, you know, that's great. He's either someone who can really conjure up his own, you know, life, or he's crazy, and I've made a horrible mistake. But he did. You know, he did win the Golden Globe. So all through the process of writing the screenplay, we would speak on the phone every day or every other day. And, I mean, he really kept me close the whole time. It was very, very, very important to him that the movie just perfectly captured the spirit of the book. And to do that, you know, he needed a lot of information. I mean, at one point he sent me an email saying, can you write out a description of all the furniture in your house growing up. If you don't know the brand names of all the furniture, just describe it. I mean, was the shag an inch or an inch and a quarter, you know, everything. And so when I got onto the set, sure enough, you know, there's my General Electric plastic ochre tape or record player that I hadn't seen, you know, since probably I was 8. And it was right there. So, I mean, he did an amazing job with that. And when I finally saw the movie, you know, it was a very surreal experience, because seeing a movie of your life shouldn't really happen when you're still living it. It's odd. You know, it's not an experience that you can really describe to people because it's so surreal. So on the one hand, it was immediately and at once like watching a home movie where everyone is so much better looking than you remember. But I was able to also step back from it, you know, and realize this is fantastic. This is an amazing movie. People are going to love this. You know, I was able to step back and appreciate it. I mean, it was, you know, Annette Bening plays my mother, and she's spectacular. She resembles my mother very strongly at that age. And, of course, she's dressed just like her, and her hair and, you know, her jewelry and everything. And, you know, to play somebody who's psychotic, mentally ill, manic depressive, you know, to play those. Often when we see that in Hollywood, it's done with great histrionics, with lots of screaming and shouting and, you know. But really, when you look at someone who's psychotic, and they're in the midst of a psychotic break, it's all in the eyes. Their eyes, the person you know and love is not there in those eyes. And that's what is so disturbing about it. But that's what Annette Bening does flawlessly. I mean, she's genuinely psychotic, you know, in the movie. She really does appear. So it's an amazing performance. I think she and Jill Clayburgh will win Oscars because they're both exquisite. Jill Clayburgh plays the doctor's wife. Brian Cox, who was the original Hannibal in Red Dragon, plays the doctor. Gwyneth Paltrow plays Hope, and she's just amazing. Evan Rachel Wood plays Natalie. Joe Fiennes plays Bookman. And who am I forgetting here? Joe Cross plays me. He's new. Joe Cross is new. But he's a real find. He's great. So this is the start of a really huge career for him. So it's an amazing cast, and they all did just a wonderful job. You know, they weren't paid $50 million each to star in this movie. You know, they did it because they wanted to, and that really shows, I think, when you see it. So I'm excited. I'm excited that it turned out to be not only something not to dread, but to be excited about and look forward to. Yes? My writing style, is it something that I had to develop, or was it just sort of there all along? Was it? And the answer is that I've always written the same way. You know, I started writing when I was in the single digits, so I'm guessing about 8. My parents gave me a blue tape recorder, and I used to take it into my bedroom at night and tell it about my day. And I very quickly, you know, it became, you know, sort of the highlight of my day, talking to my tape recorder. I then picked up journals when I was 12, 13, 14, and I wrote. I never taped anymore. I only wrote, and I wrote, you know, longhand in 5 subject college notebooks. I abandoned journal writing, though, when I got into advertising. So I was 19, 20, right there. And I started working in advertising. And, of course, I was drinking nightly at this point. So there was no more writing for a decade, until I turned 30. And I went through rehab to get sober. And I got out of rehab, and I was very excited to be sober. I was very excited to, and very ambitious, if you will, to remain sober. But the one thing I hadn't been prepared for in rehab was that there are 24 hours in a day. That was news to me. So I was kind of panicked about that. And, you know, I had to write. I had to write. So I started writing, in my journal. Every day. If I went down to get cigarettes, I would spend the next 2 hours writing about it for 2 hours, you know? So, and that was the genesis of Dry. So it's the same, but it's become more refined over the years in that I'm much faster. There's never a block. There's never like a writer's block, you know? I don't struggle with those issues. I mean, if I did, I would just write about the block and that would dissolve it. It does. It dissolves it. Oh, the James Fry thing. You know, I was down in Durham. I think it was Durham when that happened, speaking to college kids, and they were creative writing students, very upset, wondering if they should, you know, switch over to something else, get their money back, and, you know. I thought, you know, it'll be something that passes. It's like a Milli Vanilli thing that happened in the 80s when the guy was lip-syncing and it, you know, turned out. I mean, I've not read either of the books, you know, so it's hard to comment about the books and what specifically was said that didn't happen. Or I don't really know to this day if it was a marketing. Is that his publisher? Was that a marketing decision, or did he really, you know, believe it was true? So I don't know what the lasting impact of that's going to be, if any. I don't think it affected his sales, except in the positive. Will I ever write fiction anymore? Yes, I will, as a matter of fact. This is my last collection of essays for a long time. Unless I change my mind, this is it. And not because I've run out of material. I could actually keep doing this for the rest of my life. After this, I'm releasing next October. Christmas has always been my favorite holiday. And I've never had a good one. They've been hideous. So I've got a book called You Better Not Cry. And it's horrible holiday tales. And that'll be out. And that's a little half-length book, you know, little thing. After that is a memoir. It's another memoir about my relationship with my father. It's too big a story to ever fit into another book. So it's its own book. And that will be my swan song, writing about myself. After that, I'm returning to fiction. I've written 3 novels. I've only published one of them. But I'm not publishing the other 2 that I've wrote. I'm not going to publish those. But I'm returning to fiction because I love writing fiction. I mean, it becomes more real to me than the real sort of world around me. I don't outline, so I don't know what's going to happen from page to page, and it just somehow, you know, works. I don't write myself into walls and stuff. So I'm definitely going to return to fiction. It'll be, thank you very much. Thank you. Well, the next book won't be like television. It'll be very different. But, you know, hopefully I can do something really, really fun. So, yes. Writing Dry, how long did that take? Well, you know, I would have to say that it took 7 years altogether. And that's not all writing. I would say that the majority of that time was really spent editing. It was written over a period of about a year and a half, most of the material, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, if memory serves. And then it was a matter of taking this, you know, whatever it was, 1,800 pages of journal and turning them into 300 and whatever pages of book. So to do that, I wanted to make sure I had the best lines, you know, and the best pieces, and I told the best story. You know, there's so much other stuff in the journal. There's so much more advertising and so many people. So it was really a matter of editing, you know, and that's what really took so long with that. It was not difficult to write. No, it was absolutely effortless. You know, it was necessary. It was a relief. It was a relief to write. It was like a scratching a profound itch. So there was nothing about it was difficult. What was difficult was going through the experiences that are in the book. You know, that was difficult, losing Pighead. You know, I mean, I wrote all that while it was happening, and it was just horrific. It was just absolutely horrible. You know, and I'm glad that I had the journal, you know, so I could go to it, if you will, and talk to it about what was going on. But so that part of it, living it was terrible. But writing about it enabled me to live it, really. Yes. Yeah, I'm doing an hour-long weekly series for Showtime, but we're in the very, very early stages, so I couldn't tell you when that's going to happen. But it's going to be... right now I'm doing what's called the Bible, which is creating the sort of world, you know, that they live in and who the characters are. So we're not even at the part where I write the... It's totally... Yeah, it's completely fictional. It's in no way reflects my life. I can't really tell you yet what it's about, but I can tell you that it's something we've seen before. It's not new, but it's never been done true, accurately. Honestly, it's not been done accurately, and I find that stunning. It's been done very cliched, and I don't know why that is, and it's almost like you don't really... You wouldn't notice it unless someone pointed it out to you that it's not been done right, and then you'd be like, well, yeah, of course. My God, yeah. So I think it'll be great. I really do. I think it'll be really great. Am I going to continue writing for Details? Yes, I love writing for Details. It's a lot of fun. Dan Perez is the publisher, and over the years I've become really close to him and his wife, and it's just so much fun. I mean, sometimes I'll have an idea, and I'll write it, and sometimes Dan will email me with an idea, and I'll write it, and it's just great. It's so much fun. I mean, they're silly, but they're fun. Thank you. Yes? For magical thinking? No. Never heard back. And I actually have now. It's funny. I have my first housekeeper since then. And she's great, though. She's great. She's like a student. So, but no, I haven't. Yes, in the back with the black. Is there anything that I miss about the advertising business? Well, you know, there were certain people that were fun. But I don't miss doing it. I don't miss doing it. I was in it for too long. Now, I had a lot of fun when I was starting off. Working in San Francisco and, you know, working, oh boy, till 2 in the morning every night and getting in there at 5. I mean, I loved it. I didn't sleep at all. I just went home and drank really quickly as much as I could in an hour and then passed out for 2 hours and was back. But no, I don't miss it. I stayed in it longer than I should have. You know, I was in it past the point at which one should leave. I was getting, you know, so I can't say that I'm... do miss anything. I don't know that I truly have realized I'm a hysterical person. Thank you for that compliment tucked into that question. You know, it's not something that I try to do. It's not. It's just it came factory installed. I mean, it's probably a coping mechanism, you know, for dealing with a lot of ugliness. You know, one way to deal with ugliness is to pretend it's not there and put a pigtail on it, you know. And so that's what I think I did. I've always had a sort of a radar. I mean, I focus on or notice things that are absurd or funny or out of context. You know, I've often wondered too if I don't have just a wee bit of Asperger's like my brother, because there are things about me that just are so there. But I seem to be very good at patterns. It's one thing I've been obsessed with is patterns. When I was a little kid, I used to look out the window when we were driving, and I'd see like a stone wall or a you know, what do you call it, a rough wood wall, whatever it was. But I would imagine what it would feel like to touch it. And I'd make my parents stop the car so I could then get out and go see if it felt like I imagined it would feel. So patterns to me, always, I'm very good at finding the one thing that's wrong. You know, like if you lose your contact lens on a floor, I'm the one to call because I can find it. And I think that has helped me in my writing because I don't necessarily focus on what the most obvious thing is that everyone's looking at, you know? I will see something that's different. I will see something that's defective or off. Yes? Did I watch a lot of home shopping television to write television? I'll tell you that I did watch a lot of home shopping TV channels. I watched Value Vision and ShopNBC and QVC and HSN, but I was not doing it as research. I was not planning on writing a book. I was watching these shows because they're live, 24 hours. So, you know, CNN recycles, and or at least it did then. I don't know if it still does. But so this was live, and this was the only contact with live people that I had. I mean, at this stage in my life, I was just at my absolute peak of drinking and my absolute peak of squalor. I mean, I was just a mess, and I used to watch it, and it was comforting. And, you know, 2 days, you know, every couple days, things would arrive. I mean, I remember once this... I lived in a tiny little studio apartment, and I just, this carpet pad came. It was just like humongous carpet pad. You know, what am I? What? That must have been a good presentation, because what would cause me to order? I mean, honestly, can you think of anything less exciting to purchase than a carpet pad? You know, who gets drunk and orders a carpet pad? You know, like, jewelry, I could see, stereo equipment, not a carpet pad. I bought, yeah, so I definitely did. I would wake up with things, you know, purchased. Oh, it was a horrid nightmare. Yes. Who are my favorite writers? Well, you know, that seems to always change. Right now, boy, I'll tell you who my favorite writer is. Temple Grandin, Animals in Translation. Yeah, amazing, amazing book. If you love animals, or you're interested in how the brain works and how we think and evolve, this is a book to read. Animals in Translation by Temple Grandin. Absolutely fascinating. She designs the humane slaughter systems that 50 or 60 or 75% of all the cattle in the United States and Canada are processed through. She loves animals, you know, so she designs slaughter systems, and that sounds a little bit like these two things don't quite go together. But, you know, before Temple came around, these, you know, we'd have dead cows hanging up from hooks, bleeding out for hours. It was horrible. And she's made it like a trip to a spa for these things. You know, they're with their buddies. They're walking along. You know, did you see that? Did you get a load of that grass back there? You know, three of my stomachs are working on that. Yeah, that was pretty good grass. You know, I heard there's better grass. Now, boom, they're dead. They don't even know it. And that's because of Temple Grandin, you know. So I love her. Always love Elizabeth Berg and Anita Shreve. I loved the individual books. I loved, surprise, surprise, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. I thought that was an amazing book. I've always loved A Confederacy of Dunces since the first time I read that. I love Haven Kimmel. You know, there's so many that I tend to read is a lot of contemporary fiction and science-y books, you know, science books. A lot of, I like, you know, astronomy and cosmology books or books on physics that are written for lay people. I don't read technical books on physics. I don't read memoir so much, and I don't really read anything funny. Yes? How many books have I written? Let's see. Cellavision is my first book, and that's a novel that takes place in the world of a home shopping channel when controversy strikes. And then after that is Running with Scissors, which is the story of my childhood. My mother was mentally ill, and she couldn't raise me, so she gave me to her untraditional and eccentric psychiatrist. And I was raised at his house with his large biological and extended family of psychiatric patients. And there were very few rules there. That was followed by a book called Dry, which was about being an alcoholic. And getting through it. And then there was Magical Thinking, which is my first collection of essays, which were true stories from my life, from, you know, when I was a little boy up to an adult, and now possible side effects. So, you know, either of the essays are great because you get little, it's like having an appetizer plate, whatever it's called, tapas. You get to learn a little bit, and you can skip around. The difference between possible side effects and magical thinking. Possible side effects, I think, is, and I didn't set out to do this, it just sort of happened this way, but it's probably my most accessible book. Magical thinking has a little bit of a meaner edge. It's a little crunchier, you know, because there's some stories in there from written when I was drunk, you know, so I wasn't the nicest person. So, yes. How has my writing changed since I got sober? It exists. It didn't exist. I didn't write drunk. ever. I stopped, here's, I'll give you the chronology. I stopped drinking in 1999, and I wrote my first book in 1999, and it was published in 2000. And here we are. It was like that. Overnight. I wrote Cellavision in 7 days. And when I finished it, I started off drinking, you know, and I woke up one morning hungover, and I wrote the first two sentences, and it made me laugh, and I hadn't laughed for I don't even know how long. And I just kept writing it. By the end of that night, I didn't know what I had done, but I had like 50 pages or something, and I was like, what is this? It's like got a life of its own. It's like a thing. It's like a movie. Drank, went to bed, woke up, wrote more. Drank a little bit less, because now I was thinking about the book. Now I'm thinking about the book, you know, and the next day, and by the end of it, I wasn't drinking at all. There was no room for it. And I was happy, because I knew this is it. I'm going to spend my life doing this. This is it. I knew I would be published as well. And when I say that, I've said that before, and people sometimes think, that's a little confident, isn't it, Mr. Burroughs? You knew you'd be published. But the reason is not because I felt I was a literary genius, but because I knew that, you know what, I wrote a book in 7 days. Maybe it's a horrible book, you know, but it's got page numbers and chapters, you know, so it's structurally it's a book. And I can do it again, you know, I can do it again. If I have to write a book every 6 months, I will do it. I will just keep reading, I will keep reading, and I will do nothing but write. So I'll go move somewhere, cheap, 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 cheap. Get a futon computer, nothing else. You know, have one pair of Levi's, one shirt, that's it. Very monastic life. And just write until I got published. Because I knew that I would not give up. I knew that once that was made, once I realized this is it, I'm home, you know, I'm home, I was never going to stop. And I just figured, you know, this is like putting a monkey at a typewriter. It's like they say if you do that and give it all of eternity, it'll eventually write Shakespeare. And I figured, well, if you put an alcoholic, you know, down and make him write, you know, eventually the chances, it seemed to me, were high that I would write something that was good enough to be published. I mean, maybe I'd be 50 or 60 or in my 70s when it happened. So I thought, you know, this could be a really long haul. But I was okay with that. And that's how that happened. Yes. Write. Write every day. It's very, very important to write. Writing is more important than studying about writing. So if you have to choose, lose the study and do the writing. Write every day. You know, it sounds so obvious, like I'm being kind of snide, but I'm really not. Because when you're a student, when you're studying writing, there's really very little time for you to do your own writing. And that's really, really important. So writing is important, and reading is very, very important. It's very important to read challenging books, books you love, and those are kind of like your Twinkies. You can have some of those. But you've got to also challenge yourself and read things that make you think and that you wouldn't normally... You know, that's what's great about book clubs. Book clubs, you know, that's where you are introduced to a book that you normally wouldn't pick up yourself, you know, and you have to plow through it or be stoned by the other members and then talk about it, you know. I mean, who in a book club hasn't been transformed by a book that they read that they never would have read on their own? So that's what I would say. Yes. What's my favorite thing to do to relax, and what's my favorite music? My favorite music, believe it or not, is the opening theme to Car Talk, because I love that show. When I hear that, you know, life is good. To relax, what do I do? You know, the most relaxing thing for me is playing with the dogs. I've got two dogs, French Bulldogs, Bentley and Cal, and just being with them is just the best. So, you know, I'll be in bed with my computer, emailing back and forth with my posse. We email all day, every day, and with the dogs on the bed, you know, with something, the little pointy thing, and I can watch the BBC, Cash in the Attic. Oh, that's a little tea, Cody. That looks like you could get 58 pounds for that. Or I'll watch, you know, the sign. Right now, I go through cycles where I watch one channel and nothing else ever. You know, for a while it was Speed TV. That was it. Now it's the Science Channel, but now I'm on book tour and I can't get that, so now it's the History Channel. That's my favorite thing. Yes? They're spread around. The shrink himself is dead. No, I don't. I don't bump into the family. I live in a different town, for one thing, but and I almost never leave the house because I write work so much. You know, that's what I think is funny. When Martha Stewart was on house arrest, I thought, man, give me that job. I'd be fine. I'd have no problem with a house arrest, honestly. I mean, it's so not a problem for me. No, I don't. I haven't bumped into them. We don't really probably go to the same places, you know, I guess. I haven't bumped into them. It would be awkward, you know, and it may happen, but I haven't. Yes? Which one of you is my favorite? She is right there in the little peach top. The rest of you could just go. No. People, you know what? The connection occurs when I'm signing usually, because then it's quick, but it's one-on-one, and it's a very intense transference that occurs. You know, it's funny. I used to fantasize about being a writer. You know, I would always think of stacks of my book in a bookstore. I would like think that must be amazing, you know, or to see somebody on a plane reading, you know. And I'll tell you that thrill isn't quite as thrilling as you think it might have been, but it lasts about 20 seconds, and then it's gone forever, and you never, never, never get it back. Now, I don't think about my audience when I'm writing at all. You know, I don't think, is this going to be offensive? Is this good? Have I covered this? Are reviews going to like this? Never, never, never. I write for me. And what? And so when what's happened is that I have met people all over the place that have that have shared so much with me of themselves that how can I explain this so it sounds right? I spent so many years in New York City in advertising, okay, looking at real people behind a one-way mirror at a focus group, you know? I mean, New York is not the real world. It's really, really not. And I was in advertising, the most cynical subdivision of the world, you know? I'm on the road now, and I'm meeting people, Republican, Democrat, old, young, everyone you can imagine. And they're standing in front of me, and they're just, you can feel the complexity and intelligence, you know? And you can see, this is me, but it's not me. But that's me, but not me, you know? And it's profound. And that has become the thing I enjoy most about what I do. Absolutely the most. I treasure it. And it's funny because it has made me more human. I never, ever in my life cried. Never. I cry constantly now. Constantly on the road. From with people. I just lose it. I had this woman in L.A. came up and she said something was wrong with her. You know, something was just wrong. And I said, hey, what's the matter? Are you okay? And she just went, yeah, I'm good. And she just lost it. Her friend forever, her best friend had just died of cancer. And it hit me as though it happened to me, seeing her. It absolutely killed me, and I just wanted to be able to download. That's the one thing I know, is when you lose somebody, it doesn't get better. It doesn't heal, but you learn to live without it. It's like losing a leg. It's not going to grow back. Don't listen to people who tell you you need to hurry up and be over it. You know, if you're going to grieve for the next 5 years, do it. You can't ever rush it. And if you don't finish it, it'll really damage you. But you need to accept it's never going to be better. It's never going to heal. But you will be okay. You will learn, you know. And so that kind of exchange, I mean, imagine that on a daily basis. You know, it's very, very intense. Yes? How and when did I meet Dennis? I write about that actually at length in Magical Thinking, but it's kind of a long story. He placed a personal ad online. He was sort of talked into it. Very inexperienced. He actually, his therapist, he'd been single for 10 years. His therapist said, you've got to date. You've got to make an effort. Some friends said, you should do online. He was like, what's online? You know, so he didn't know. So he's looking, and he saw an architect that he liked, and he wanted to respond to the architect's ad. And he didn't know how these things work, and he thought he has to write an ad in order to answer it. So he wrote an ad, put it up, and then wrote the architect and said, okay, here's my ad. And, of course, didn't hear back from the architect. But he had, you know, all these personal email responses and was overwhelmed. And nothing worked out, so he was taking the ad down. And that was the day my email came through. And his business partner, Dennis owned a graphic design firm in the city, his business partner said, oh, no. She's from Kentucky. She's like, you answer that right now while I watch you. I don't trust you for later, you know. And so that's how it happened. We'll take one more. Someone from the back who doesn't... Okay, sir? Yes. The writing in dry, written while I was... There's not a lot of writing in dry that takes place while I'm drinking, because I didn't write. So the writing that takes place in dry was written either while I was actively drunk, and there's a section in the book that exactly was written in that way. It's where I relapse, where I describe the... I'm sitting at my computer writing that, and that's literally word for word lifted from my journal. There aren't a lot of experience. I didn't go back and write about experiences that happened when I was drunk so much as write about them right then and there when they're fresh. So things that happened when I was blacked out, I don't remember. One thing that I'll tell you is that there are just enormous missing pieces of my memory from my 20s. You know, my sobriety, what's covered in dry, you know, is relatively intact. But the stuff that led me to going into rehab, much of that is gone. Much of it's gone. I mean, I did a lot, you know, when I was in New York drinking. I mean, I went to a lot of very strange places with a lot of strange people, and I did a lot, and a lot of that is simply gone. Thank you all very, very much for coming today. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Berg, Francine Matthews, John Barrett, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 17th, 2006.